No one likes pop-up ads online, and many of us actually block them. But Ken Fisher, who is editor-in-chief of Ars Technica, says doing so may have unintended consequences for your favorite websites.
Everyone knows that the internet is chock-full of great information, opinion, and community. What everyone doesn't know is that blocking internet ads can truly hurt the websites you love. If everyone did it, a big part of the internet would soon be gone. Many people believe that if they never click on ads, then blocking them won't hurt a site financially. This is wrong. Most ad-supported websites are primarily paid when an ad is viewed. If you have an ad blocker running and you load 10 pages today, you've consumed resources. Sure, bandwidth is a pittance for one user, but multiply that by a few million and it gets expensive. Imagine a business where one out of every three people you served costs you money, but doesn't generate anything in return. Now imagine how much better service you could provide were this not the case. That's why you have to think about the sites you love. Blocking ads on those sites can be devastating. I'm not arguing that blocking ads is stealing. Yet it can indirectly result in people losing their jobs. It can result in fewer articles, videos, and chats for you to enjoy. And it can definitely affect the quality of content. It can also put sites into an advertising death spin. As revenues go down, many sites are lured into running horrible advertising like pop-up ads, or their pages explode with ad units all over the place. If a site has advertising you don't agree with, just don't go there. Vote with your page views and tell the site operators why it is you're leaving. Online, everything is 100% trackable and it's billed and sold as such. On TV, advertisers don't know if you're muting the ads or grabbing a snack. That's why they try to make catchy ads and they only pay for potential results. Online, every single ad loaded matters. Now, obviously, this isn't all the user's responsibility. Advertisers and publishers have to get serious about creating a better experience. They need to recognize that if they offend, they are fueling future ad blocking.
Ken Fisher is editor-in-chief of Ars Technica and author of a forthcoming book on building online communities. Mind-reading machines are no longer just science fiction. For several years, scientists have been experimenting with devices that can detect patterns of brain activity associated with simple things like a carrot or a hammer, and now a team in the UK reports success in decoding much more complicated thoughts. NPR's John Hamilton has the story.
Our brains devote a lot of space to our own autobiographies. And Eleanor Maguire of University College London says autobiographies are built on memories of important events.
You know, when you got married or when you first went to college or when this or that happened. So these are very much the events that shape our lives.
Maguire was part of a team that wanted to know whether traces of these so-called episodic memories could be detected in brain scans. So they found 10 volunteers who agreed to watch several very short films. The films served as proxies for real-life experiences.
In one case, a woman came onto the screen, rummaged in her handbag, took out a letter, and then posted a letter in the mailbox. In another one, a woman came on screen, finished a cup of coffee, and then put the disposable cup in the trash can.
Maguire says the volunteers watched the films over and over until they had formed a strong memory of each episode.
And then we popped the people in the scanner and then had them recall these movies.
The scans recorded activity in a part of the brain called the hippocampus, which seems to help organize episodic memories. Then the team used a computer program to search for patterns of activity associated with each film. And Maguire says it found them.
In every single case, it was able to predict with high accuracy which of the memories those 10 participants were recalling.
Each person's brain had a unique pattern associated with each film clip. That's what the scientists expected to find. But Maguire says a comparison of all 10 brains showed something else that was really surprising. The pattern associated with, say, the woman mailing a letter didn't vary much from brain to brain.
It was really similar. The parts of the hippocampus that were involved in being able to discriminate between these memories. So it was incredibly consistent across individuals.
Other scientists say that seems to be true for lots of thoughts.
We all have very similar patterns for a given concept.
Marcel Just directs the Center for Cognitive Brain Imaging at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh. Just says it's pretty easy to put someone in a scanner and tell whether they are thinking about a face, for example. But he says that by studying a particular brain in particular situations, it's also possible to get much more specific information.
We asked people to think about the face of various members of their family, and to some extent we can decode which one they're thinking about.
Just says mind-reading experiments like these rely on the cooperation of a person being scanned. They have to think about something over and over. So far, there's no way to use a brain scanner to forcibly search someone's memories. But Just says the ability to detect what a person is thinking is progressing with remarkable speed.
At the extreme, maybe we could decode somebody's dream while they're dreaming. Imagine that, having somebody in the scanner go to sleep, and they're dreaming, and you can say, okay, ice cream cones, you know, white horses, whatever. Is that possible? Not this year, not next year, but I think that's doable.
And Just says that is likely to touch off a discussion about who will get to see the thoughts in our brains. The new research appears in the journal Current Biology. John Hamilton, NPR News.
This is NPR. What a book is worth used to be fairly simple to calculate. There's the author's fee, printing, shipping, marketing. Calculating the right price for an electronic book is a little different, and consumers think e-books should be cheaper because they cost less to produce. But publishers are afraid that if the price goes too low, it will put them out of business. NPR's Lynn Neary reports.
E-books, says Jason Epstein, are on the verge of utterly transforming publishing, a business he has worked in for more than half a century.
It is the most exciting event, as far as books are concerned, in 500 years.
Epstein, a well-known editor, publisher, and author, is a fixture in the book business. Writing about the future of publishing in the New York Review of Books, Epstein noted that many publishers fear e-books will make them obsolete.
There'll be no inventory. There'll simply be digital files, and they'll be available worldwide at the click of a mouse. This makes much of what publishers now do irrelevant, creating an inventory, putting it in a warehouse, keeping track of it, selling it, shipping it. All that's going to go.
But Epstein says even given all those changes, it's a mistake to assume that at this point an e-book should necessarily cost less than the printed version of a book.
There's a serious misunderstanding there because the publishing companies do today exist and they do have all that overhead and they have to pay for it. And so that has to be figured into the cost of an electronic book. It's not just the cost of transmitting a file. So it's misleading to think that just because there's no physical book that the costs all disappear. They don't.
E-books may be getting all the attention in publishing these days, but that belies the fact that they remain a small fraction of the market. And that, says James McQuivey, an analyst with Forrester Research, is why publishing is in such a tough place right now. A revolution may be underway, but it's by no means complete.
The problem publishers face is that they're organized around analog economics, you know, that are decades, if not centuries old. And so from their perspective, cheaper books threaten that.
McQuivey says publishers know they can't stop the revolution, but they do want to slow it down, and maintaining a higher price for digital books is one way of doing that. They were frustrated when Amazon set the price for e-books at $9.99. So when Apple unveiled the iPad with its e-book reader, they seized the opportunity to make prices more competitive. Now, most of the major publishing houses have negotiated a higher price for newly released e-books. McQuivey says publishers are trying to inhibit the sale of e-books by artificially inflating prices, which he believes is a mistake.
The pricing genie is already out of that bottle because if you go to Costco, you go to Walmart or Amazon.com, you're going to find hardback books that have been available for 2 weeks that are on sale for $12 and $14 in hardback. How can you explain to a customer that they should pay the same price for a digital edition? It just doesn't make sense.
One person who certainly doesn't see the sense in higher e-book prices is 25-year-old Chris Dannon. A freelance writer who specializes in technology, Dannon makes the argument that e-books should be dirt cheap. Dannon believes publishers can trim a lot of fat from their budgets right now, cutting back on expenses like marketing, for example. Dannon is sympathetic to publishing's dilemma, but he says they need to leave their old business model behind.
They should be pushing for people to convert to the new medium. They can do whatever they want to support the old medium, the printed medium, but they have to get people used to the idea of buying and reading electronically simply because that's more profitable.
Dannon says publishers should be finding ways to make it easier, not harder, to buy electronic books.
If you're able to get your books in front of more people, which you can when they're electronically distributed, right? If you have iTunes selling your books, you have this entire store right on everyone's desktop, and you can expose them to a lot more. You can just get them into the habit of buying books. And more importantly, you make the process of buying completely frictionless. I mean, when you buy something on Amazon, you have that one-click purchase power.
But Jason Epstein warns the old and the new ways of getting a book to market will be competing with each other for the foreseeable future, and publishers are not yet in a position to abandon their old ways of doing business altogether.
One thing that publishers do have to consider in thinking of pricing is that they don't want to liquidate their existing retail structure by making it so inexpensive to get an e-book that people won't go to bookstores at all. And then publishers will have no place to sell the 90% of the books that they do create in the physical form.
It's too soon for questions like pricing to settle down, says Epstein, but they will eventually. And once things do settle down, Epstein predicts a future for publishing that looks not unlike the past, when a small team of editors helped shepherd a writer's book to market with relatively little interference from management. And that, says Chris Dannon, is the promise of digital publishing for young writers like himself. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
Students tried to spice up their applications with mini homemade videos. As NPR's Tovia Smith reports, they hope that their short movies will take their applications a long way.
If a picture is worth 1,000 words, then you've got to figure a video would be worth way more than your average college essay.
Hi, Tufts. My name is Rachel, and this is a glimpse into my life.
Tufts University, which is known for its quirky application questions, invited videos this year to give kids another way to express themselves. They ended up bombarded by more than 1,000.
I'm a zealous girl with a lot of personality.
I'm your average teenager in many ways.
They are as earnest as they are unforgettable.
I have been a dedicated member of the Star Twirlers baton twirling team for 5 years.
I can cross one eye, do the wave with my eyebrows, and even wiggle my ears.
Other impressive on-screen feats include a guy who literally runs up the side of a garage, one who muses aloud in 5 languages, and...
Hi, Tufts! I wrote a song for you guys.
A range of musical talent.
So now please don't take too long to accept me.
Some of the performances come in on DVD, but most students just post their videos on YouTube and send Tufts the link. So admissions officials are not the only ones watching.
This is the kid who I thought was really good.
Which one?
Online and on campus, fans like current Tufts student Kate DeClerc have made some of the freshman wannabes into stars. For example, Math Dance Girl, who does a kind of bar graph ballet.
I'm here to show you how I combine two of my favorite things, being a nerd and dancing.
She's got nearly 10,000 hits on YouTube from groupies like Tufts senior Erin Flood.
That was awesome. So cool. If she doesn't get in, I'm going to refuse to accept my diploma.
Tufts officials insist that's not going to sway them. They say they're too busy reading and watching applications to comment further, but other admissions officials say the idea of allowing any part of a college application to be public makes them cringe. As Henry Broaddus, Dean of Admissions at the College of William and Mary, puts it, this just adds to the already intense pressure on guys like him.
It invites, second guessing, and you know, inevitably people are going to try to reverse engineer the decision process and even wonder, what did they do that I didn't? That's the part that concerns me the most.
Broaddus says he also worries the videos put too much focus on style over substance.
You know, this isn't American Idol, nor is it a pageant.
But try telling that to the students watching YouTube, who can be just as harsh as anything Simon Cowell ever dished out.
This one's horrible.
He's not getting in.
Admissions officials say students should think carefully before deciding to send in what is still an optional video.
If humor is not something that comes naturally to you, this isn't the time to take that risk.
Dartmouth's Dean of Admissions, Maria Lascaris, says she worries about piling more pressure on students. And it's only a matter of time, she says, before kids start looking for extra help on their videos, like they do with their essays or SATs.
You know, all of a sudden, do you hire professional, you know, videographers and Francis Ford Coppola or James Cameron to sort of direct a sort of slick presentation? Don't want families to think that's what they have to do next.
But Lascaris says there's probably no stopping the videos now. It is the language of this generation. She says even after they're accepted, some kids send another video just to show their gratitude. Tovia Smith, NPR News, Boston.
Back when personal computers were taking off in the mid-1980s, Apple Computer aired a now famous ad during the Super Bowl. It was a play off George Orwell's 1984, and in it, the world is gray. From a giant computer screen, a Big Brother-type person spews out propaganda. That is, until a lone woman runs toward the screen and smashes it with a hammer.
On January 24th, Apple Computer will introduce Macintosh. And you'll see why 1984 won't be like 1984.
The message was clear. Apple was providing a choice to consumers. But in today's tech circles, there's a growing discussion over whether Apple has now become the man that it warned against so long ago. In a few weeks, Apple will release the iPad. It's a portable touchscreen computer similar to the iPhone or the iPod Touch. And like those products, it will only run on Apple's operating system and only with applications approved by Apple, sold only through Apple's online application store. Farhad Manju is a technology columnist for Slate, and he's with me from KALW in San Francisco. Welcome.
Hi, good to be here.
First of all, describe how the Apple Application Store works.
Yeah, so for all computer systems, we need to get software to make our computers do more things.
Right.
And for PCs, we're used to just buying software from any store or going to the web and downloading stuff. For the iPhone and the iPod Touch and soon the iPad, what you have to do is go to the app store that it's built into the device. And there's a little button. You click it. You choose whatever kind of app you want, and it downloads instantly, and it's on your phone or your iPod Touch, and it runs instantly. So it's very convenient.
And Apple owns the store, and so they get a cut of everything sold.
Yes, they get 30%. So if an independent developer creates a program, they sell it for $1. The developer gets 70 cents. Apple gets 30 cents.
Now, this week, a group called the Electronic Frontier Foundation got hold of and then published an Apple corporate document, which the company had kept secret. And it's basically a contract that the developers have to sign before they can even create applications for the iPhone and the iPad. What did the document reveal?
Yeah, first of all, it's pretty remarkable that it's been secret all this time. And one of the reasons it's secret is because there are 100,000 developers who are creating programs for the iPhone, but they all have to sign this document. And one of the provisions on this document says that they can't publicly speak about it.
So what are some of the restrictions?
One of the things that you can't, that Apple has the right to do, is to remove any app from the store at any time for any reason that it determines. It doesn't even have to state a reason. Actually, we've seen this happen many times since the App Store opened, for various reasons, some of which seemed reasonable and many of which seemed completely arbitrary.
Why does Apple make these products so restrictive?
Apple wants to make sure that everything on the iPhone and the iPad is easy to use, and also that it should sort of live up in a certain sense to the Apple brand.
Well, what is the tech community saying in terms of the implications of all of this? I mean, given that Apple is the gatekeeper, what does this mean for consumers, especially in the future?
So it sets up, as I see it, a dangerous precedent, because we're used to this sense in computing, in the computer industry, that things are becoming freer all the time. But there's this fear now that Apple and devices like the iPad might come to restrict computing again. And in a general sense, it kind of places limits on what consumers can do and what developers can do. And you know, people in the computer industry see this as dangerous for innovation and kind of dangerous in general for the industry.
That's Farhad Manju. He's a technology columnist for Slate.com. Farhad, thanks so much for joining me.
Great. Good to be here.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Audie Cornish. In Austin, Texas, hundreds of innovators in film, music, and technology are gathering at the annual South by Southwest Festival. Coming up, Weekend Edition Sunday host Leanne Hansen reports from the festival on some of the new technologies on display there. But first, I'm joined in the studio by Vivek Kundra. He's the man President Obama has charged with bringing the federal government into the world of 21st century information technology. And he's here to talk about some of those efforts. Vivek Kundra, welcome to the program.
Adi, thank you very much for having me.
So you are the Federal Chief Information Officer, and that's in the Office of Management and Budget. Are you head of the Geek Squad? What exactly do you do?
So part of what the CIO is focused on is to leverage the power of technology, as the president has said, to move the government to the 21st century, to make sure that the investments we're making in information technology across the federal government serve the American people. Why is it that I can go on, whether it's TurboTax or Tax Cut, and file my taxes and have access to them for the last 3 years, yet when you go to irs.gov, you don't have access to that information? Why is it that the student aid application process has been so complicated for so long? It's more complex than filling out the 1040 form. Why is it that it takes over 3 years to actually file a patent? And that's what we need to do, is we need to start putting the people who are using these systems at the center, not people who are managing these systems.
You just got back from a visit to the West Coast, where you visited companies like Amazon and Apple and Microsoft. And you've talked in the past about how it might be a good idea to use systems or networks run by these companies as opposed to sort of government data centers.
Yeah, what we're seeing is massive transformation happen in the private sector, where they're consolidating and they're leveraging technologies such as cloud computing.
So cloud computing, for a good example for people at home, might be if you use something like a Google program, Google Docs, where your Word documents or your Excel files or whatever you have, you store them with Google. You don't store them in your house on your home computer. Are there any, I guess, to start, just privacy concerns in doing business or having the private sector do our business for us?
Well, this is not going to happen overnight. This is going to take a decade in terms of this transformation. But we want to make sure that the industry addresses security and privacy concerns. But the U.S. government will not and should not move any system to the cloud that in any way violates national security or the privacy of the American people.
I want to move on to one of the projects you're working on, which is the Open Government Initiative. And what's really interesting about it is this interactive element. And in plain speak, it's the ability of the public to really try and give the government its ideas about how to run things better. So give two examples that my mom can do at home with her pretty basic home computer setup.
Sure. So she can go online on, let's say, HHS.gov.
Which is Health and Human Services.
Health and Human Services. And she can contribute to the public dialogue that's ongoing today to say, hey, what we would like to see is more data around the healthcare system.
So is this a comment box, or how is it different from what we know already?
So this is the ability to comment, to put in comments. And then what happens is other people are actually able to rate the comment and rank it and give feedback to the agency to say, you know what, we love your mom's idea and we think that idea should be the first one. And what that's going to do is actually inform public policy from an HHS perspective.
So if one idea, if my mom's idea becomes the most popular of the day, then the odds of it being seen by the head of HHS are high?
Not just high, but part of the directive requires that they incorporate that feedback as they're creating the plan. So it will actually have an impact on how the agencies is going to move forward as far as hardwiring this culture of transparency and open government. Another mechanism in terms of the way people are participating is, let's say, on the tech front. developers. So we launched a platform called data.gov, which essentially democratizes data for the American people.
So this is a website where you've had all the different agencies. They've been told the data that people have been asking for, you have to put it out there in a raw form that they can download and use and manipulate.
Exactly. As soon as we launched data.gov, a developer went online and created an application called flyontime.us that essentially allows anyone to see average flight times across the country, average wait times at airport. So if you're flying from city A to city B, you can actually plan accordingly, or you can book your ticket accordingly.
So these are government apps.
These are apps being developed by third parties. They're not being developed by the government. So this is part of what the president wants to do. The president wants to be able to engage the American people as we address some of the toughest problems we face.
Vivek Kundra is the federal chief information officer, and he joined us in our Washington, D.C. studios. Mr. Kundra, thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.